When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You're about to listen to the Sevilla dossier, the scouting notes Graham passed on to Liverpool's European scout in a conversation before the 2-2 draw between the teams at Anfield in September. This is a preview for the team's second meeting in Group E on Tuesday, November the 21st, and the full episode is free. If you'd like to become one of our growing army of over 650 big interview socios, head to patreon.com/GrahamHunter to unlock hours of bonus shows, including big interviews with Robbie Keane, Ledley King, Rafa van der Vaart, and Kevin Phillips.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of The Big Inside View. We have Graham Hunter on the line from Seville. I tell you what, I'm looking out of a window on a Scottish sky that can only be described as battleship grey. How's things looking from your end? Tell us a little bit about what you're looking out on at the moment.
Well, I don't know the actual name of Roman Abramovich's yacht, but that's the kind of feeling I get when I look out my window. It's Tommy Hutchinson Coventry strip blue in the sky. The buildings are all of white because it's 37 degrees, and that's Celsius, not Fahrenheit.
Tell us a little bit about your day quickly. You obviously flew from Barcelona early this morning. You're on UEFA duty for Liverpool Sevilla tomorrow night. How does your day look? Your press conference, training tonight?
Yeah, you prep the night before. I'm up at 6, Vueling flight down, and we landed in Sevilla. It's a really quick journey from the airport down Avenida Kansas. We're not in Kansas anymore, Toto. Straight down to this part of Seville, which is romantic for me. I've mentioned before that the hotel I'm in is 5 minutes walk from the Nervión, or Ramon Sánchez Pizjuán, if you like, where the stadium is. But it's also 4 minutes walk from the main railway station, outside which both Graham Runcie and I and about 50 or 60 other Scotland fans slept because we were impoverished and, what would you call it, relaxed.
Yes.
In 1982 after Scotland-Brazil. So it's a nostalgic sight for me, but there'll be none of that sleeping on the pavement tonight because we've got business in hand. The business began with Eduardo Toto Berizzo and his press conference just after lunchtime. Very flattering that he gave me a little nod and salute as he came in and sat down. Alongside him was Jesus, the press officer of Sevilla, who is a gentleman and a scholar and loves Skull and has been to, I think, every Scottish League ground, or at least all the Scottish Football League grounds in all four divisions as it was when he made that claim to me in 2006, I think. a football nut, passionate about Sevilla, almost as passionate about Southampton. And alongside the two of them is Pablo Sarabia, who will definitely start against Liverpool, one of the touchstone footballers for Toto Berizzo. And interesting chat with both of them. Good, proper football discussion in that. That's the tone that Berizzo sets. You're allowed to ask questions about tactics, about strategy, about individual player strengths. And therefore, although Sevilla is not a city without that screeching search for headlines or polemic, it is nonetheless an atmosphere at Sevilla where the reporters are encouraged to, and therefore do, ask about football. And anybody who's listening into this podcast and doesn't understand what a rarity it is to have football reporters asking about football, rather than looking for back pages.
That'll never catch on.
Never catch on. That the practice of football reporting should be more based upon understanding and analysing and reporting the game and its players rather than polemic and finger pointing and invective.
Just in terms of that kind of layer of analysis that, you know, you seek to bring to the work, I guess like training's quite important. I mean, you're very passionate about attending training sessions, and it was a big thing for you when you moved out to Spain. So are you going to go along to training tonight and try and draw some intelligence from what you see in front of you?
I think I could draw a lot of intelligence and improve my perspective. I've never used this phrase before, and we didn't rehearse that you were going to ask me this, but I've often, just explained to anybody who doesn't know what Martin's referring to, just briefly, I've always said that one of the driving forces to move to Spain and to pursue my journalistic career here was simply that in the old days you were allowed to see almost every training session of every club open, and you accredited yourself and you went and watched for an hour or 90 minutes or whatever it was. That's changed a little bit. Some clubs still do allow you in. Today, yeah, I'll be going to Liverpool training tonight. Sadly, it's only 15 minutes open. The thing I've never said before, I've never put in context of this, that I bang on about my desire in 2002 to see training. It was like, no matter whether you use words well, and then on top of it, you believe that you have an understanding of football, you believe that you read it well, that you envisage it well, that you interpret it with some degree of aptitude. The one thing is, you know that you'll never prove that until you put it to the test in a culture where you're expected to write about football rather than just descriptively. I knew from a relatively young age that something about the way I phrased things or the adjectives I used attracted people who read them, something. And that's not, you know, trying to blow my own trumpet. It just was a factor that I recognised. And I could have leaned on that and said, so long as I can describe the atmosphere or the colour of a football occasion well, or write up an interview, then, you know, can coast along. And that didn't appeal to me at all. What appealed to me was going to training so that I could, one, build relationships, two, understand a little bit more about the correlation between daily work and what we see on match days, and then three, I try to test what you see and what you believe you've learned in conversation with coaches and players. Sometimes that's gone well, sometimes not, but it's definitely advanced the level of trust I have from the football industry over here, at very least. I think it served me well in Revista. But every time that I go to training, I genuinely think, will I understand what I see? Will it improve me in any way? Am I quick enough? And, you know, I go not in order to be able to mention that I've been at training or in some sort of belief that will make me superior to others. You're always testing yourself. If a week is a long time in football at a club or with a national team, then why not take advantage of and try and understand body language, watch rondos? And very rarely do we get to watch strategy, but sometimes we do. And the more often that I do, the more comfortable I feel about describing things later.
I want to take you back to a conversation you had with Liverpool's European scout before the first game between the clubs in September, where I guess it was more of an informal conversation, but you gave him a kind of technical, tactical debrief of how you saw Sevilla. So we thought that would obviously make for a great podcast. And can you kind of take us back to that conversation, how you saw that Sevilla team and the challenge that Liverpool faced in that first game and will face again tomorrow night?
Yeah, I like Michael Crompton and enjoy speaking with him. And it was just a coincidence that we were able to sit down and talk. And he is very assiduous, very, very far travelled. He's one of those advanced scouts who tries to look at patterns, tries to look at strategy, tries to look at individual players' strengths and weaknesses in the opposition. He knew me, so it was positive to be able to sit down and share ideas. When we spoke, you know, I had no incorrect assumptions that I was helping split the atom for him. But I think that one of the things I like is the scouts that I meet from the UK have open minds, because it's, I compare it to myself. When I go abroad and I meet somebody who I think is in a position of teaching me something, later you can discard it if you want, but you process it, you listen, you ask the right questions. I was picked up today, just that tendency. I asked a few questions in the press conference today, and Sevilla's own radio station, at the club, said, "Will you come and talk to us?" And the way they introduced me, so you're always asking about tactics, you're always asking about strategy, and we want to know why, and blah, blah, blah. So when we were, what I liked about chatting to this Liverpool sort of analytical scout was that he had an open mind, irrespective of what he'd seen already. He had a very open mind about what else he might be able to suck up in terms of details. I said at the time that my biggest fear about Sevilla was that they were athletically slow across the pitch. Not every player. There's tremendous pace, obviously, in Jesus Navas, in his way. There's very good pace in Joaquin Correa, who I think the Argentinian winger is going to be, if not a superstar, then an absolute top-quality footballer who, if his form continues to grow in the way that I've seen over the last year, 18 months, then he will be able to play for any club, anywhere. He's superb. Still growing, still learning, but he's exceptional. Look, I'm making the point too extended. Escudero's quick. But as a team, when they lose the ball, Sevilla, particularly in midfield at that time, and this is the big change since that first conversation, and Liverpool would have seen this at Anfield. When there was a midfield three of Steven Nzonzi, who, you know, I think the world of, I guess we've mentioned this in the Big Inside View before, I've chatted to him a lot down here, and I've chatted to players who were with him at Stoke and Blackburn, and I see an enormous change in his confidence. I see him blossoming in La Liga in an identical way to a guy he resembles in Freddy Canute. He resembles him in height and stature. But Canute told me when he was at Sevilla that the biggest thing he loved about Spain was that the La Liga allowed you to use your intelligence to prove your quality. Whether it was your teammates or the media or the fans, they appreciated quality of play, intelligence of play, and end results. Whereas in Canute's view, when he was playing in London, you know, Spurs and West Ham, you proved your worth initially by sweating right through the jersey. And that irrespective of the scenario, you chased the football like an enthusiastic puppy would chase a tennis ball. That wasn't for Canute, and there's no coincidence that, you know, the trophies he won playing for Sevilla, you know, would fill a cabinet, whereas, you know, he was regarded as a shirker in London. It's crazy now to look at it. And Nzonzi was thought of as a player who perhaps was a little bit lethargic, a little bit slow, and I've heard phrases like, you know, difficult attitude. And here, he's the boss. And the concept of pausa, where you introduce intelligence and control to a moment of play that says, is it accelerate or is it decelerate? Is it wait for positional change around you, or is it open the other team up because you've got a gap and a player that you know can take advantage of your pass? That's, and Bereso called Nzonzi his regulator, his controller of play today when we were talking. And that aside, he needs to have all those things, Martin. He needs to control the play, because if the ball gets past him, he'll work, he'll run with you, but he's not lightning fast. And then when beside him, in those days, you're going back to the beginning of the group, they were playing three in midfield and three up front, and the three in midfield were Nzonzi, Pizarro and Banega. And Banega has never been quick. Fabulous passer, a sort of Juan Roman Riquelme player, maybe not as good, but with the passing range, with the prompting, with the vision, a real orchestrator of quality creative play, but not the same level of control as Nzonzi. Much less fearful of losing the ball, Banega. And then you have the worker, Pizarro, who's Argentinian, who's beginning to break into some of the plans of Sampaoli at the international side, came from Mexican football. And he is not simply a destroyer, but he is, you know, big and tall and lean and strong and will win the ball and in certain circumstances can help you asphyxiate a midfield game. But when you put those three together in a 4-3-3, teams could run past them. That's as simple as that. And if they were caught out of position, then it was hell on earth. And when I was talking to the Liverpool analyst, what I said was the combination of those players plus Eduardo Barroso's absolute commitment to attack. I mean, anybody who wants to get just a mind flash of what I'm talking about is go to the game where Celta Vigo played at Old Trafford in the semi-final of the Europa League last season, having been comprehensively outplayed by Mourinho's team at the Balaidos in the first leg and beaten. They took a proposition of football which was so open, so attacking, so daring to Old Trafford that I think to some extent it resembled, with a little bit less force and quality, the Athletic Bilbao side that put Fergie's team out of Europe so thrillingly under Bielsa. And that's Eduardo Barroso's idea, is to be front foot, controlling the ball, but controlling the ball in an offensive way, getting at teams. And when you do that, they will inevitably, particularly in the early months of an idea, of a philosophy, you lose the ball. There will be lack of understanding, that, you know, people will try a clever pass, it'll be given away. And at that point, when that three midfield was being run at, problems. But in Liverpool, at Anfield, having gone 1-0 up, what was, I think, a snapshot of everything that I'm trying to say is that Pizarro went off. The Argentinian organiser giving strength in that midfield went off. And Nzonzi looked as if he was being left on his own in midfield, isolated. And at a time when Liverpool were charging at Sevilla, it kind of looked as if, you know, the Sevilla could be flooded. And instead, what happened was this, and anybody who was at the game will recall this, whichever team they were supporting, was just this sort of block by block, Nzonzi built calm, built passing, built rhythm, brought other players into the game. And I knew that he preferred playing on his own. He told me so in an interview last year, that the more space he's got in order to give order to the play, the happier he is. The more in which he feels that there are players, his own players, to the right and left of him, the less room for manoeuvre he thinks he's got. Because he's a guy, and listen, it's not visual, it's audio, but I'm moving as he does, looking left, right, forward, swivelling, setting up again, moving, giving it, taking it back, opening up an angle. It's beautiful to watch. And I'm not calling him world elite, but he's very, very good. And I'll summarise on him by saying that last December, when I was at the Champions League draw, Monchi told me, Juventus have told us that they're coming in to buy his buyout clause, which is 30 million. They didn't in the end. They picked up Matuidi from Paris Saint-Germain, and fair play to them. So the change didn't come immediately once Nzonzi bossed that game at Anfield, once Pizarro was off. But as the weeks went by, one of the really big things was Barroso, the coach. Martin, do you consider it a strength or a weakness when a coach will go and ask his players about how they want to play?
I think it's a strength. I think it's probably a very small minority that have the confidence to do that. Yeah. It probably takes a certain type.
That's the phrase that I think, and I imagined you'd say, that some of the traditionalists would say that to ask, to give the player the power of an opinion was to undermine your own position. Whereas the elite coaches will have the plan in their head, will have the confidence to go through with it, but will stuff as much information into their head as possible. And all I would point out is that Barroso, who'd been a, you know, hard, aerially able centre-half in his time in Spanish, French, Argentinian football, he took time to listen to Nzonzi, changed the shape from 4-3-3 to 4-2-3-1, and maybe people think that that is a tiny difference. Maybe people don't see the relevance, but it gives Nzonzi, and usually next to Pizarro, the room to say to Pizarro, you know, you're tidying up, you're at the breakdown of the ball, but then give it to me. And then it's not quite quarterback, because he'll pass it short, medium and long, short, medium and long, and repeat until he carves the game open. And therefore, the new shape very important to Nzonzi. And what it does is it tests Banega, who goes in the middle of the three behind the striker. And Banega wants to be the guy lying deep, picking up off the centre-half's toes and spraying long passes. So getting that equilibrium now, compared to the team that Mike saw in the early part of the group, to the one that's emerging now, structure-wise, Sevilla are a little bit less prone to being ripped apart by pace as they were in Moscow. Anybody who watched Spartak at 1-1 with Ben Yedder, the striker that they signed, who looks, you know, he's the shape of Romario, but, you know, not just barrel-chested, slightly barrel-tummied, small, you know, a fine finisher, but not the world's most sublime athlete. He has a one-on-one in Moscow for 2-1, which should have been buried. It doesn't go in, at which point Sevilla dropped their guard and Spartak Moscow ripped them apart through counterattacks again and again and again and again for a 5-1 humiliation. And there you see the difference between Anfield, where Liverpool looked like they were going to absolutely flood Sevilla with goals and didn't, to Moscow, where Sevilla missed chances, Nzonzi wasn't fit, wasn't playing, and every time they went out the pitch, the Russian team scored. Now we're at a compromise position whereby it's still the case that the players who are not athletically fantastic, Pizarro, Nzonzi and Banega, are in the team, but they're in a better shape in order to deny their weaknesses and expose their strengths. And that's what's changed for Liverpool in the meantime, albeit that I would accept that Klopp's team has improved, is quicker. Salah's integration, not just as a finisher, but his partnership with Firmino, I think, is... People keep talking about Salah and records and pace. That's fine. But you know that when you get a player like that, who loves playing next to his strike partner and who's got an intuitive understanding with them that they're working on and improving every week, that's the thing that really attracts my eye at Liverpool. And I think that, you know, Sevilla are in danger. That's the answer to your question about the chats I've had with Liverpool's representative about this team. It's evolving, but it still has more of an Achilles heel than you would want receiving this Jurgen Klopp side.
I mean, it seems like that one tactical change from the 4-3-3 to the 4-2-3-1 will make for a completely different type of game tomorrow night. I mean, the flow of the first game was bonkers. I mean, for an hour, Sevilla weren't in the game at all, and then finally they managed to wrest control of it. But it sounds like they're going to be better set up tomorrow night, whatever happens, and we can expect to see a different flow to the game.
I think that's definitely a point I'm trying to get across. I do believe in that, and Barisso sat here today saying again and again, give me intelligence, give me precision, give me equilibrium. He said, I want to press them high, I want to make them uncomfortable. We're playing to win, not to draw, because a draw would not be in any way disastrous for Sevilla, who faced Maribor away in the last game, whereas Spartak and Liverpool must play each other. Now, Barisso means that. That isn't mouth music. But irrespective of the fact that he keeps insisting that it's going to be about not giving the ball away, about using the ball with intelligence, using Nzonzi as the regulator of the play, the hard fact is that at the back, Parejo and Carrizo, an Argentinian and a Portuguese, probably would be starting. They're out long term. The two centre backs that you would that have the biggest experience and are the most reliable in hand to hand combat when it comes to playing elite sides are out and won't feature. Simon Kjær is the Dane who helped put Ireland out of the playoffs and has had a really difficult settling in process here. Well, he's carrying back pain, and therefore Lenglet is the French central defender who looks elegant, who scored a crucial goal against Spartak a couple of weeks ago here and has a composure and elegance at his age which suggests that he's a high-quality European player, particularly given one of the ideas that he was brought to play at full-back. Then you've got Johannes Geis, the German, who just couldn't get a sniff of a game. In theory, he is an organising or semi-attacking midfielder, and he's playing at centre-back, or has been. Did it at the Camp Nou when Kjaer came off, and did it at the weekend against Celta Vigo when Celta really, Martin, could have scored 3 or 4 instead of losing 2-1. And therefore, you've summarised exactly what I think, that the structure of Sevilla is better, that it suits their key footballer if they're going to be precise and they're going to be balanced, and that's Nzonzi. But behind him, that idea that the fullbacks will be Mercado, an Argentinian who's an automatic pick in the team that Messi will take to Russia. Mercado can play centre-back or can play right-back, and therefore the idea of Mercado playing at centre-half is not out of this world, given that there are Cochea, the Frenchman, can play at right-back. So that's a possibility. But it'll be, I think, Mercado at right-back and Escudero, who's a special footballer, at left-back, pushing into midfield as wing-backs to get up and down, not to help Nzonzi, but to be up and down. And Nzonzi dropping or Pizarro dropping to be the third man in front of the two centre-halves. And at that point, if that high-risk strategy is unpicked by them not doing what the Argentinian coach has asked them to and losing the ball or giving the ball or doing what you said. He said, no quiero una locura. I don't want the game to be madness. And that kind of sums up what you were describing, that Anfield hour.
When
Sevilla went ahead, but really were being pummeled by the time they got back in the game. He doesn't want that, but he might get that because at the back right now, Sevilla are not right. And it's for a combination of circumstances. But they have problems. And that's why I think it's legitimate. If Liverpool fans are listening to this, I think that, I think Sevilla are unbeaten at the Nervion for a year. And that, for that reason, it's just absurd to say that it's a gimme 3 points for Liverpool. I think they go into this game as favourites. And certainly, unless Sevilla are excellent, there's a gaping opportunity for Liverpool playing the way they are right now, with their midfield functioning and their strikers taking the pressure off the fact that, you know, defensively they can be irregular. I think that Liverpool come into this with slightly superior form, slightly superior footballers in key positions, and therefore they're slight favourites, Martin.
I have to say that Berizzo added to the madness himself by like two great moments of comedy where he threw the ball away like a petulant school kid twice and then seemed stunned. And then seemed stunned that he was sent to the stand.
He's been really funny about it because he did it the first time just out of pique because he felt that the I think there was an incident on the pitch whereby he's like, why didn't you stop? And therefore, if you're coming to me for the ball, then chuck it away. And he got a warning from the referee. Now, I really, really admire this guy. I like talking football to him. I think he's going to be, I may have proven already, but he needs to get trophies. I think he's going to prove to be a very high-level coach. You know, I'd welcome him at any club that I was watching regularly. His football ideas, his manner, his willingness to talk football, his confidence, all of that. Total thumbs up. But I'm not being defensive. I'm simply explaining what he said himself then and today with good humour about that. He said that the second time he throws the ball away, it's to disadvantage his team because he recognises the previous time he was completely in the wrong. So that was at a point when Sevilla were chasing, I think, a winner or at least a second goal. And he felt that at that stage he would... It's a ludicrous idea, but he says at that stage... It was my team that wanted the ball that quickly. And all I was doing was trying to show that I was in the wrong before, but I could do it both ways, which is kind of like, I never mind the rules. We'll just do it my way and we'll get equilibrium. We'll get justice my way. Well, the referee didn't like that. Old Kloppo didn't like it. And as you say, he was sent off. But it was raised again today in the press conference. And somebody said, listen, Paul, you and Klopp, you know, did you get a chance to sort of make your peace at the time? And will you do so? I guess it's not need to make a peace. Klopp was fine. He said Klopp was fine to me during the game when I was sent off. He said it was totally my fault for doing the wrong thing. And he said we had a really good cordial chat afterwards. What other manager uses the word cordial? I love that, man. He said, he's the regulator of my play. And we had a cordial chat. I flipping love that, man. Berizzo, listen, I think he had a reputation of being a pretty wild, pretty fierce, occasionally temperamental centre-half. But in this instance, he reckons he was just applying a little bit of twisted Argentinian logic.
Right, okay. Well, give him the benefit of the doubt this time.
Well, he also said, listen, it was all my fault. So.
Yeah. I noticed Neil was asking you to call the Madrid derby on Friday. I think you called the result, if not the scoreline, which is pretty good. But why don't we have another run at it? How do you see it panning out tomorrow night?
Listeners, socials, Martin Gregg, do we believe in this idea of the 12th man or not? I think some people do. And I think having talked at such length about the Calderon on Friday with Neil, it'd be stupid to dismiss it as an idea. One of the things that I take into account, having been at some extraordinary atmospheres where, as you try to soak it up, you think to yourself, this must be influencing events a little bit. Over my career, whenever I've asked players who are willing to speak and are willing to take a concept and not just give you a stock robotic answer back, aye, the fans are great, that'll help us, or no, I never hear the fans, I'm too concentrated. Sometimes players that I trust will say, look, certain fan bases in certain stadia at a moment where there are our fans and I'm flagging, or there are fans and we need something heroic, or they're the away fans and we know we're in bad form and they're on us. I think at that stage, that 12th man, it can be a vitamin boost, or it can be like, you know, your laces tied together a little bit. And Sarabia, who, you know, is probably, I don't know if you can even think of his playing style, Martin, or who he is or where he comes from. And I wonder if that's the same for a lot of socios, because he is not high profile. But Sarabia is a footballer who under Sampaoli had very little protagonism. I don't think that Sampaoli saw his attributes as being all that important, although it grew a little bit towards the end of last season. Under Berisso, this guy is now knocking on the door of the Spain squad, which is, you know, an extraordinary feat given how many good players are already queuing to get in to the 23. And Berisso said about Sarabia, not only is he an excellent footballer, he's at the top of his game, he has the capacity to make others around him play better. And I asked him today, like, what does that mean? What, when he says that about you, can you explain either what you realise that you do or what you think he's talking about? And he was really good, Sarabia. He went straight to the point. He went, look, let's take pressing. He said, pressing is a unified effort. Because this coach wants us to press high, it's obligatory that the wingers, the outright wingers, and the striker and the 10 go after the opposition defence if they've picked the ball up and they're trying to play it out. And if they've recuperated the ball high up the pitch for us, they've won it in a tackle or from a goal kick, we still have to press high. He said, my job is to play out to my very best, to play with intensity, but to be contagious. And another phrase I love there, contagious. He said, for strikers to press in the right way, they have to be convinced. And that, isn't that beautiful? And he said that conviction comes from knowing that the guys behind them, i.e. me and those around, will be doing the right things in the right area of the pitch every single time. And he said it's my job to make sure that, one, those who press know that we're exactly where we need to be to squeeze and help them make sure that if the guy just gets past them or is nearly away from them, we're there to clip things up. Or that I will show those around me, if they're not where they should be, I'll bring them up. Now, I thought that was a really good, intelligent, quick example of what an underrated player who's got football intelligence can do and how he can describe his own art. But he also said, look, I've been at the Nervion here many times as an opposition player, principally for Getafe. And he said, you notice it. You notice the pressure this crowd puts you under. And he said, now that I'm a Sevilla player, you know, I feel we float on their wings sometimes. So coming to Ramon Sanchez Pizjuan against a Sevilla side, which is full of gifted ball players, means that when you ask me for an analysis of what the result will be or why, you have to count that it's possible for Sevilla to have a special night and to take advantage of the fact that Klopp is a very attacking, sometimes reckless attitude, that the central defenders at Liverpool are not elite and not close. I'm not confident at the moment. And that Mignolet, albeit that he can have a night where you think nothing's going past him, he can also have nights where you think, yeah, he's going to drop something or he's going to dive over something, which is unfortunate, but I think it's accurate. So the idea of Sevilla winning and qualifying for the next round is what Barica called the primary objective of this part of the season is not outlandish. I think that they should be very happy if they get a score draw because it leaves it back in their hands with the easiest away game of the group left for them. And then, frankly, I've already said, and I meant that if Liverpool show the cohesion and the accuracy and power and pace that they showed in the first game against Sevilla and that I witnessed against Southampton at the weekend, then what they do well, unfortunately, jigsaws right into what Sevilla don't right now do particularly well. So I have Liverpool as minor favourites to win, but I think it's, you know, it's far from outlandish that this should be, it could be an exciting score draw, and that the Nervion just gives Sevilla's slightly less athletic players a little bit more oomph and a little bit more concentration, and the group is still entirely alive amongst the top three by the time match day six comes along. I tell you what, Martin, it'll be passionate. This stadium rocks to the anthem like very few stadiums in Europe do. And the fact that there will be travelling Liverpool fans, given that you'll never walk alone, means that this is going to be one of your most vivid and colourful and passionate European nights of the first half of the season. And, you know, maybe you can tell from my tone or from previous broadcasts. I can't wait.
Graham, I'm reliably informed that Big Kloppo is currently waiting on you to start his press conference, so I think it's time you got on your bike. We'll speak to you later on in the week. That's your time.
I have a horrible feeling that you probably will, yes.
We hope you enjoyed that free episode. Sign up now to become a Big Interview Socio and unlock 4 exclusive Big Interviews and, coming on December the 1st, Graham's chat with Jermaine Defoe. Patreon.com/Graham Hunter.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has 2 limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.